Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 155. We got a great guest today, a guy who's doing some really cool stuff in the college strength and conditioning realm. He's in baseball now, but prior to that has actually done some really cool stuff, particularly in the track and field realm, also worked at high level soccer. So he brings a really good, breadth of perspectives on this, and then also some great depth in specific ways as well. So a progressive guy that I really like to talk to, and I've known for quite some time and seen him do some cool things over the course of his career. So I think he fits well with this trend of us looking outside the baseball world to try to learn specific applications that we can apply to the athletes we deal with. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it's difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where Athletic Greens can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. And that's why I use it daily and recommend it to our athletes. One scoop of Athletic Greens contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, including a multivitamin, multimineral, probiotic, green superfood blend, and more. They work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet, increase energy and focus, aid in digestion, recovery, and supporting of a healthy immune system. This all can happen without taking multiple products. While most nutritional products come to market and stay stagnant, Athletic Greens continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing 53 improvements over the last decade. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best daily nutritional habit on the planet. It's lifestyle friendly, whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, and contains less than 1 gram of sugar without compromising on taste. They put 75 ingredients to the NSF for Sport certification to come up with a formula that's trusted by some of the world's best athletes, including our own. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving our listeners 10 free travel packets with their subscription. Simply go to athleticgreens.com/Cressy to receive my offer. These travel packs are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health when you're traveling for games, training, or simply when you're on the go. They can be a great counterbalance to less than ideal on-the-road food options. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance to get nutrient diversity, then head to athleticgreens.com/Cressy and get your 10 free travel packets today. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. Today's guest is the Assistant Athletic Director and Director of Olympic Sports Strength and Conditioning at Clemson University. Previously, he served as Assistant Director of Olympic Sports Strength and Conditioning. He oversees the strength and conditioning for all 14 of the Olympic sports that train at Clemson and is directly responsible for strength and conditioning for the baseball team. Previously, he worked extensively with men's soccer and track and field. Prior to becoming an assistant coach, he worked as a graduate assistant at Clemson, where he worked with the football and Olympic sports teams. During his time at Clemson, he's worked with 10 ACC champion track and field squads and has also worked with 8 individual NCAA champions and 7 Olympians in track and field. Previously, he graduated from Colgate University in 2006. At Colgate, he spent 3 years as a student assistant strength coach after his football career was cut short due to injuries. He's a certified strength and conditioning specialist through the NSCA and also holds the SCCC certification through the CSCCA organization. Please welcome to the show, Rick Fransbaugh.
Rick, thanks so much for joining the show. This is definitely long overdue after as long as I've known you, but I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no, awesome. Glad to do it. And I'm a frequent listener, so it's an honor to be on.
First time caller. I like it. hey, man, I know your history. And honestly, it was I thought it was a really cool story. The first time we got to know each other back when you came to our Massachusetts facility. Man, that was probably like 08 or 09, something back in that timeline. But, for our listeners, maybe speak a little bit to your background, how you wound up. Obviously, you're at Clemson now, but you had an athletic background and a strength addition kind of upbringing before that.
Yeah, so I think similar to a lot of other coaches, is initially got playing sports growing up and throughout high school. As I got towards the end of my high school career, encountered a lot of injuries. So I had shoulder done a couple times, knee done a couple times. Then as I kind of matriculated to college, Colgate University, play ball, had a few more surgeries, was medically DQ'd. So that really kind of got me going on my path of diving into strength and conditioning. And, you know, that's really at the end of the day, kind of the root of my why is I never got to answer the question if I was good enough. And for me, it was always I wanted to play professionally, to play in the NFL. Probably wasn't going to be good enough, but I never got to really see that all the way through. So that's kind of underlies my mission and my why as a coach is just providing the best for the athletes I work with so they have the best opportunity to answer that question for themselves. And, you know, fortunate to be in a place like Clemson now where we have athletes who want to play professionally one day. And I'm just trying to do the best job I can to serve as a vehicle to help them get to that point. So football career ended early, started as a student assistant at Colgate for a couple of years. And then as I graduated, I sent a letter out to, I think, every Division I school in the country, and Clemson was one that answered. And here we are 17 years later. I've been in six different positions there, but just been really fortunate to be in a good place surrounded by a lot of people where opportunities have continued to present themselves. And just, you know, it's a unique trajectory, but one I'm certainly fortunate and I've been really blessed to be in the positions that I have been.
That's awesome. And, you know, we're kind of in the middle of this podcast run on, I'm kind of learning from other sports than baseball, right? So we're talking to NHL folks and basketball folks and MMA and all that stuff. And, you know, on the surface, you know, this that wouldn't necessarily apply to you as you're, you know, the Clemson baseball strength condition coach. But as you implied, your athletic history actually was much more outside of baseball. And I think in our conversations, that's been a real blessing in disguise. So as we, you know, we look for, you know, other sports to see how we can improve our own. You know, you obviously spent 18 years working outside of baseball. You know, what were the advantages for you, you know, to being a generalist for so long, you know, prior to obviously, you know, specializing a little bit more? I know you work with, you know, men's soccer, track and field a little bit as well. You know, were there perks to being a generalist before you became a specialist in this baseball realm?
Yeah, 100%. I think over the, you know, over your experiences, you develop these different lenses you can look through. And with each sport and the nuance, you dive down different rabbit holes. So for me, I've worked with just about every sport here at Clemson, minus the basketball teams. So the last 2 years, actually the first 2 years of my career, I've just been with one sport, with baseball. Mm-hmm. Past 8 to 9 years was track, soccer, baseball, then eventually just soccer and baseball, but and football before that. But really, I think, if I'm going to go back to track and some of the lessons I learned there, first one, which I know we'll probably talk about later on, is really my first kind of insight and foray into understanding different structures of the body. So that's when I really started to understand I didn't think of it in terms of the ISA at that point in time. It was kind of, I took the concept from Dan Pfaff. So Dan used to talk about mechanically and fascially driven athletes. Mm-hmm. And I could see that in the weight room. I could see that in their individual force signatures. And it kind of gave me a basis to really understand that these different structures affected how people produce force, how athletes produce force, and, you know, inherently changed kind of my mental model on training. So the background on track was super helpful with that. The example I can give is I remember one of my first years, I think I was still a GA, I was working with the sprinters, and we had a real narrow guy who back in the day, so I was thinking fascially driven athlete. You know, we're doing like some heavy singles on squat, and he crushed 365, just down and up, blew it out of the water. I'm like, oh man, this guy's got 40 or 50 pounds on him. So then we put 405 on the bar and he gets stapled. Mm-hmm. Guy, but now looking through the lines, I understand, super narrow kid, didn't have a big IR window, can't grind. So even his higher intensity work is going to look really fast. So much of that and these early conceptions and mental models of it really started in track. And also, too, I think, you know, the other thing with track is the understanding of vertical integration of all the stressors. So really in track, because you're getting measured and there's a very direct correlation, there's a sprint time, a jump mark or whatever it may be, is understanding how to integrate your strength training, your sprint work, your plyometrics, your med balls. And understanding global stress management was really, really helpful. And I think, you know, as I started to work in the soccer and then baseball more, that background was tremendously helpful. And then in soccer, I think the biggest the biggest takeaway and what's helped in baseball is my background there and using a lot of GPS is our practice planning and micro cycles for the week, our preseason planning. So, you know, I got to the point with soccer where I'd draw our whole preseason. So the undulation of high, medium, low days, pitch parameters, the duration of our different segments, our minute accumulation of our players through our first couple exhibition matches. So I really got an understanding of kind of these weekly micro cycles and learning how to reverse engineer from a first match or from opening day. So like now we have the GPS, we use Catapult with baseball, is, you know, as guys come back in January, we're reverse engineering from understanding what typical weekly loads are for the position players. So can't tell you how helpful the background's been in all these different sports as now I finally become a pseudo specialist in the baseball realm.
But you know, I think it's so important is, you know, what you just implied without actually straight up saying it is there was a massive exposure just to a large body of athletes, right? It was all different types of track and field athletes. I mean, you go on a soccer field, like what a forward, a midfielder, a defender, and a goalie do on a daily basis is markedly different. You talked about GPS, right? Like what happens when you have a guy that's getting 20 minutes in games versus playing entire games? Like, do you make up for that fitness capacity? Do you pull back and try to, you know, prioritize speed qualities rather than endurance qualities? And I think that's vitally important. And it's probably what's helped to make you successful in baseball is I think we both know this is an industry where, and I'm especially mindful of it, is you go into minor league systems and, you know, you have 180 players domestically. You've got 26 men on your major league roster. You've got 90 guys at your Dominican Academy. And then you have, you know, a collection of players that are on the IL. Like that's over 300 players in most organizations. And, you know, it's like speed dating, getting to know them. So inherently it's a sport that is, for whatever reason, good or bad, it's created like this one program on a dry erase board dynamic. And as an industry, we can do so much better, you know, and I think it's cool to see guys not only doing it, but borrowing from other disciplines in order to make that really happen. You know, and it maybe kind of leads into my next question, because it's probably a derivative of individualization, is that, you know, transfer is this massive topic across all sports, right? We've got a lot of people obviously in the skill acquisition realm that are becoming more and more prominent now and rightfully so. But I think it's particularly the case in baseball where the relationship from speed and power to actual performance is probably less direct, right? Like we have a lot of one trick ponies who have, you know, long fingers with good changeups or splits, or they understand how to get to the front of a baseball, or they're hypermobile, or they can contort their bodies in all different places. You know, what are some strategies that you've employed, you know, not just necessarily in the baseball realm, but across the board to shorten the learning loop, to take what you do, you know, on the strength conditioning side of things and actually favorably impact your pitchers, your hitters, obviously your defensive players on the position player side as well?
Yeah, great question. I think really for me, it starts with understanding what is the specific transfer that we're looking for and working under the framework of we're trying to reverse chain this process, right? So really, I start with this. I start with a positional skill hierarchy. Okay. So what position do they play or what is their role? So am I a power hitting left fielder that is in there for offense, right? Am I a shortstop who, then when I talk about like a skill hierarchy to play shortstop at a high college level or professional, you have to have defensive agility and defensive skill first and foremost, right? Like those, if those aren't on the table, can't play the position. So inherently understanding the importance of those skills and then underlying that is, you know, offensive skill, offensive power. So understanding within these different positions and within that, the different roles on the team, kind of what we're looking to get out of each player is a really important starting point. And then from there, that's when I really go into their assessment stuff, their individual structure. So we'll probably get into this more later, their archetype, wide versus narrow ISA, their configuration, so the relationship between their pelvis and their thorax, kinematics, so if we do have motion capture or just simple film, the kinetics, so if it's a hitter, their, you know, all their bat sensor data, the post-contact data, a pitcher, you know, all their ball metrics, all these different types of things. So understanding their structure, how they produce force, what their skill and role is, and then lastly, kind of their individual player assessment stuff. So kind of the process we work through as a team. And then from there, we kind of reverse engineer it. So I give an example, say, I'm just thinking of our team right now. Like a catcher we had a couple of years ago, still on the team, was kind of a underdeveloped wide ISA catcher. Bat speed wasn't great. Had good bat to ball, so his offensive skill was high, but we thought there's a lot more offensive power there. Pretty good receiver, pretty good defensive agility. So for him, the emphasis, there's a lot of emphasis on strength, okay? Wide ISA, strength transfers really well. So we're pushing that envelope for a long time. He's put on 20, 25 yeah. pounds. The bat speed's gone up a lot, okay? And the biggest area of projectability for us and offensive power, we helped out. Now, on the flip side, I may have a real skinny, narrow pitcher, like a 6'6", but he's super compressed, okay? Maybe he played basketball in high school, or just we know these tall, skinny guys, they get super compressed in general. So as a super narrow individual, generally the unlock or their superpower is their rotational capability. Yep. So for him, it may be, yes, we're going to push strength, but that's going to be more of a latent benefit of a lot of the movement and positions that we're trying to unlock. So for me, all this work up front, understanding, you know, what their skills are, what their role is going to be, all these other different measurements. And from there, then kind of reverse engineering and starting to understand and develop a plan for these guys. So I think when we really get targeted with that and we're trying to reverse chain it versus forward chain it. So forward chain it is, okay, these are our weight room KPIs. It's squat to body weight ratio, or it's peak propulsive power on a counter movement jump, or whatever it may be. Targeting those may sometimes lead to what we want, but in other instances, it may not. It could actually be detrimental to what we're after. So I think doing the work up front helps us hone in on developing a really specific and nuanced plan to get the specific transfer that we want. And I think the other thing too is the mental model of what we can achieve in the weight room needs to evolve. Yes. I think a lot of times it's, I can only achieve outcome or output based measures, right? I can improve bat speed or exit velocity or pitch velocity. Those, well, I can also do some things to improve adjustability yeah. in a hitter, right? I can do some things to improve command. Like, I think we need to get out of this thought process that we are only valued and measured in how we're driving outcome or output measures, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. So yeah. I think that mental model is really important too, and kind of understanding the whole spectrum of how this interplays.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's, and there's a couple of things I'll unpack from there. And your last point is like that's where strength conditioning comes in youth sports, right? More and more kids are specializing than ever before. Like it's our job not just to try to keep them healthy, but one of the avenues through which we do it is by providing a rich proprioceptive environment to build that foundation, to give them a collection of sensory inputs so that they effectively, you know, develop strategies, whether it's for blocking a ball in the dirt, or hey, I'm a right-handed hitter and I've thrown my pelvis, you know, counterclockwise, and I get fooled on a changeup, and I need to make sure that I can keep my thorax back, you know, moving clockwise at the same time to give me adjustability to, you know, effectively still make contact. So I think that's really important. But you know what I loved, and I when you were using the example of your freshman catcher that kind of came in underdeveloped, the wide guy. You know, it got me thinking is that, you know, that plan isn't just the same plan forever. You know what I mean? Is we both know that kid comes in, mm-hmm. you put 150 pounds on his squat, he turns into a beast. And junior year, you roll that same plan out, he gets worse and he might even get more banged up. Like how many guys have we seen go into like big time D1 weight rooms that are stars for a couple of years? You know, they basically get their newbie gains, and then all of a sudden they just deteriorate, or the program itself actually, you know, it takes away from what they need. You know, that kid starts to really lose rotational capacity. You know, he turns into a block. So like how often are you kind of, I guess, reassessing, not necessarily like just putting your hands on them, but more importantly, like just reevaluating the whole plan? Like, is it a sit down with your players, you know, every semester? Is it every time they get back to school after, you know, summer ball and you guys reconvene? When do you guys reconnect to figure out how the plan needs to be pivoted?
Yeah, great question. I think for us, it's really, really fluid. And what I really lean on is the relationship and conversations I'm constantly having with our baseball staff. So yeah. I've been really fortunate here, working with head coach Jack Leggett, Monty Lee, and now Eric Bakich, and all the supporting staff. They've been tremendous to work with and really buy into what we're doing. But that's like the beginning of the fall when we have our player development meetings. Like, I kind of really start the conversation as in, here's the body, here's what it's capable of being able to do, and kind of going through whether it be, their movement in the box or on the mound and my lens that I see it and conveying to them their input. And then we kind of work together and come up with the plan moving forward. But that relationship is incredibly important. And we're always having conversations. So we have a director of player development, Ben Paulson, who's tremendous, and him and I we're always talking constantly. But I think the thing that really helps is I look at film as much as the coaches do for the most part, right? Because I'm trying to see. So, and this is a nice thing. I'm a pseudo specialist now, using my air quotes here. is like I'll write an individualized like warm up plan for all of our guys. It takes a ton of time, but it's absolutely kind of reverse chaining from what we see and how it changes over time. So, even within that, it's not like we just have these three kind of checkpoints throughout the year, but it's this fluid state that we're always back and forth. So we give the example like the catcher is, he gets stronger, he's a wide, he's making use of that big IR window, bat speeds go up, exit velocity goes up. But then, like you said, I could drive so much anterior to posterior compression that I start squishing him like a pancake. And then he's got his spaces to move, start to turn laterally. Okay. So now he's loading as a hitter in like a sumo squat, okay, a big ER orientation. He loses his IR downforce window. And now he's flying out of his backside really quickly, right? Or he's rolling over. If he's a right-handed hitter, he's rolling over his left side. So I personally use film an awful lot. And also backing it up with some of the other metrics like bat sensor, like some of those instances an attack angle may change or some other things like that. So kind of using those and honestly being super fluid. And if I see an adaptation that we've changed in the kinematics is, then we'll quickly alter the plan in the weight room.
I like it. Just to give folks maybe a little bit more foundation, some of the stuff we talked about, we've had some good conversation in the past about how, certain athletic archetypes, specifically under this umbrella of the infrasternal angle, this is the ISA that Rick's been referring to for those at home who haven't, been familiarized with it. And definitely go back and check out the podcast we did with Bill Hartman. We touched on it a little bit there and, Bill's work and, in terms of kind of popularizing, looking at ISA and in combination with a lot of stuff we've seen from the Posture Restoration Institute has had a really, powerful impact on how we train athletes. I think let's dig in deeper on the patterns you observe, what they mean for pitchers, hitters, sprinters. This is stuff we look at super meticulously, with our athletes and it drives a ton of our training decisions. I'm not sure that the strength and conditioning community at large really appreciates it in depth, but they also don't appreciate that even if they just have a cursory understanding of it, what a big difference it can make. And then, I think we could probably overlay it on some of the mechanical versus fascially driven athletes, right? So like the folks at home understand like a Jacob deGrom, a Tristan McKenzie, these are fascially driven athletes. These are the guys that you look at and you say, this guy's throwing a ball 95 to 100 miles an hour. It makes no sense. They're not muscling up. It's very much, synchronization of a lot of systems, elite rotational capacity, elasticity that's driven by the fascial system. And that generally fits very closely as you noted with a narrow archetype, but maybe build out some of your big picture thoughts on this and we'll throw some ideas back and forth.
Yeah, certainly. So, and really it's been game changing and all the credit to Bill and learning from him and being able to apply this, not just in a baseball sense, but across all of our sports at Clemson. But it is really the lens in which I see all movement nowadays. Mm-hmm. I think the most helpful thing has been it's allowed me to connect the dots a lot quicker and ask and get closer to asking the right questions. So if we kind of zoom out, like our narrow archetypes, more expansive in nature, more ER biased, So they're going to have more yielding type connective tissue is going to be their bias. So if I think of like a hitter, so they have more of an ER window, they have a much smaller IR window. Mm-hmm. So when we think of their force signature, they're going to be good at producing forces in small windows, right? Because they don't have this big, long IR to slow down and create the force versus like a wide. So if I think of in terms of hitting, generally what I'm going to see like bigger loading type patterns, right? So they need like this big ER on ramp to build momentum to then flash their down force, which is what internal rotation is in their forward move. So generally, not always, but usually set the hands a little higher. So as my hands go up, I unweight myself and it's easier for me to push down, which is remember what the narrows struggle with. So hands are usually set higher. There's a bigger loading mechanism. Okay. And then also like a narrow is going to be more of a low pressure system. So if I think of like a skinny syringe, okay, versus a wide being like a big fat syringe, okay, that big fat syringe, it's going to pressurize a lot more and a lot quicker. So a narrow needs time to build up that pressure. Okay. So we see these bigger rotations, bigger forward moves. Like I said, the hands are usually higher. Now here's another really other important point. And this is, I think I got so deep into this because I've made so many mistakes over the years with this, Eric. And just like realizing all the maladaptations used because a preconceived notion that was really false earlier on is, so if I look at the pelvic structure, the narrow more ER bias, and they have more of a counter nutation, bias. So their space is in the anterior outlet. So they're going to be more squatty in nature, right? The wide is going to have more of a nutated sacrum. So their space and expansion will be posterior. So they're more hingy. And this is where, you know, a few years back, I was making a lot, you know, there's the big hinge push. Like everybody needs a hinge. Like pitchers need a hinge, okay? Well, then what we started doing with a lot of our guys is a narrow. They don't have the space to counter nutate. So how do they create the hinge type position is a ton of anterior orientation and internal rotation from the lower lumbar spine, right? So this is where we see like our guys that get into these real hingy type positions are more our wide archetypes. Our narrow hitters tend to be a little more positive shin angle. And then two, because of this pelvic position, if I think of a narrow, they have more of an eccentric anterior outlet. They're going to create force by creating differential in the left and right outlet. Mm-hmm. So what we see with these hitters, they tend to be more front leg loaders, okay? Or they're more like single leg type jumpers. So if you really look at them at kind of heel contact for a right-handed hitter, so it'd be left heel, okay? They tend to be loading more onto the front side, okay? Versus a wide who has that concentric anterior outlet, okay? They're more of like a double leg jumper. Yep. Basically, those are so like this is where I made a mistake too. Like we used to teach everybody like 50-50, right? 50-50 a heel strike. Well, yeah, that's probably much more the case for a wide because that's their advantageous position because that the outlet, the anterior outlet, can develop that concentric position and pressurize up. So. And I'd say the last thing too with hitters too is oftentimes a bat path too. So generally you'll move more along your helical angle. So a narrow has more of a steeper helical angle, the wide wider. So oftentimes I've seen too, some of the narrows have an easier time creating a more vertical bat path.
Yeah.
So if I think of like a ball down in the zone for a hitter, like a narrow can kind of move along their helical angle. Versus like, there's a great video I have in like a presentation. I think of Mike Trout, who's super wide. He gets a ball way down the zone, hits it out of the park, but it's like all side bend.
Yeah.
Right. Cause he has to do that because he can't create kind of that bat path along his helical angles. So those are just some of the nuances within hitting. But when you start to peel all those layers back, it's really, really helpful. And then you go back into the weight room. Okay, and that's okay. So our squatting versus hinging preferences in our movements. And then I think the other piece that's super important is understanding impulses too. Mm-hmm. So wide has that bigger IR window. So they're going to be better at grinding type exercises or, you know, heavier loading without developing necessarily compensatory strategies through that. Where like the narrows, it's a lot of quicker impulse type stuff. Mm-hmm. Because they don't have that big IR window, if we take a narrow, we load them super heavy and they do a lot of grindy stuff, they're going to do it from a more of like a late ER type position and drive a ton of anterior orientation. So this is where we super compress those narrows an awful lot. And then on the pitching end, okay, we see a lot of the same things. So even starting at like handbrake, so along the helical angle, so a narrow, generally have a steeper type handbrake, a wide will be a little wider. Now that can get thrown off if they have like a more ER'd ISA due to some compensatory strategies. But generally the move along their helical angle, the narrows be more rotational in nature, right? So they have that eccentric anterior outlet, so the guts can fall down and they have room to rotate versus a wide that doesn't have that as much. So they're more rotational. And then you see it a lot in tempo too. So like a wide, like they pressurize so quickly. So this is oftentimes what you're going to see like a bullpen guy, bullpen arm, who kind of has a real short, like side slide step, right? Short arm action, pressurized really quickly. Your example would be like DeGrom or McKenzie. Okay. It's kind of a slower build into an explosive, an explosive effort. Right. So
a lot more of a drift feel to it, as opposed to like a guy who just sits in his back hip seemingly forever. You know, as a good rule of thumb, you look at pitchers, like if you see a really classic vertical shin with a big hip load, it's probably a wide guy. And then, you know, if you got a guy who's got like a right-handed pitcher where that knee is just like collapsing towards third base, but they just seem to have so much rotational capacity, they can get themselves out of terrible positions. They're immediately situated. They're probably a narrow. What I look at, and I don't know if you're the same, like the first thing I look for is weird stuff that doesn't make sense. Right. Like narrow guys with big time wide presentations and their delivery, kind of like that classic really straight front leg, which seemingly takes their entire center mass, just gets it going like completely into bad positions. You'll see like weird narrow ones that, you know, present with vertical shins because they got super limited ankle mobility for whatever reason. So sometimes that can be a blessing and a burden. But the conversation I always seem to have around this, I'm curious if you do the same, is sometimes you look at the positions and the positions themselves from a pure just joint angle standpoint aren't bad. But I talk about it's not just positions, it's actually pressures. Like where are you actually, you know, because you'll see a narrow guy that's just like hanging out in his knee. And then you'll see another guy that maybe in the exact same positions, but you can see like he's actually finding like his posterior hip capsule. Like he's able to use that to preserve some element of direction. So I always say like there's positions, but there's also like pressures. Like where do you feel it? Where are you working into the ground? Those are just as important.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you hit on a good one. I think one I was making a mistake with for a while is when kind of a few years ago, like drifting became popular, and understanding that is it's, if you just look at it, and the DeGrom's a great example because there is a big drift, but really all that is, that's me producing force from like a late ER position, which is what a narrow has. So the picture I was used to explain is I'm teaching to like skill coaches is I use like Clemens versus DeGrom. Mm-hmm. Clemens was almost like a balance point guy. Yep. He was going to kind of drop and drive because he had the window and access to that. And there's so, you know, hips are underneath him. He's got a lot of downforce, like a lot of your narrows. And the more narrow you are, generally you're going to be these guys that have these bigger drift patterns. But I think that's where we have to do a really good job of coaching up pitching coaches and skill coaches so they understand these and they're not blindly kind of coaching some of these strategies into our athletes, which we see like all the time. You see with guys coming to CSP or the Yankees draft picks is like they've been coached into something that doesn't align with what their structure and hardware is.
I think it's always about finding windows of adaptation, right? That's a huge part of these discussions is what have you worked on in the past and what haven't you worked on? You know, and if you take like these big pictures, like you look at most of the guys who are wide that have had success on a mound, like they thrive when they understand how to rotate in a narrow hallway. Like I've heard guys say, like rotating in a phone booth or rotating in a narrow hallway. A lot of these narrow guys, that doesn't work for them because they actually have some faulty direction that they can make up for either because they got a really aggressive glove side that puts them on line. They've got a super quick arm. Like, you know, you would never teach Chris Sale, you know, how to throw like he is, but he's clearly self-organized to the point. And I've never worked with Sale, but you can pretty much make the assumption that he's a narrow, just like, you know, the DeGroms and the Tristans, you know, and sometimes you try to like, you know, teach an aggressive hip load and get him more in a, you know, in a hallway. And, you know, it might help a little bit if it's a really extreme thing, but in many cases, there's a level of deception. There's a sweeping slider. There's something that's going to be really good from the angle. So we have to be really careful about trying to fitting, you know, all these folks into one mechanical model when their bodies are all so dramatically different.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. And I think failed to bring that up, but even that's kind of what we hit on earlier is working backwards from ball metrics and understanding kinematics as well, too, is like there may be, or like say, yeah, Chris Sale, like the horizontal approach angle is probably out of this world, and especially to like a, you know, a left-handed hitter is, yes, the center of gravity translating really fast forward on that left side could be a problem, but it's also his superpower. So I think it's like we said, as we get tons and tons of reps working with similar type structures and deliveries is trying to get to the point where we can understand an optimal and healthy bandwidth for these. I think the other one too would be, we see a lot in pitching now too, is induced vertical and vertical approach angle is some of the means in which these guys are achieving it are not built for long-term sustainability. You know, some of the climbing of the arm and elbow to create the ER and kind of compensatory layback is, it may be helping them create a lot of induced, but they're using the medial elbow for a lot of expansion and driving some problems down the road. So that's where we have to keep getting better in terms of really having sniper precision of asking the right questions and understanding some good, I think heuristics in terms of safe bandwidths for some of these outlier type characteristics.
What I come back to is, you know, are you preserving motion? Like, and that sounds like a really, really basic thing, but we have all these outcome measures. We have these predispositions that we see from athletes. And if you get a kid that comes in and you've got him for 3 years and he leaves with range of motion equal to or better than when he arrived there, like the program's worked. But if you have that athlete that's losing 10 degrees of hip internal rotation every year, like that's generally not going to end well. And what do we see with these narrow guys? Yeah, typically you can load them up pretty good and they're still going to hold their rotational capacity. You take a wide guy who's already pretty highly trained and you try to take his deadlift from 500 to 600, you're probably going to give him a whole bunch of extension-based low back pain and make him substantially worse. He's going to hate standing around, you know, during spring training in his cleats for 4 hours a day. But, you know, what's interesting is I've actually, one particular athlete comes to mind in specific, but, you know, a guy who is a super narrow guy, hits the ball incredibly hard, but started off his career actually with a really, really big swing. Like it was long, it was arms and legs flying everywhere, huge hip shoulder separation, and actually worked over the course of the career to tighten things up. Like everything that he did from like a training standpoint was about not getting too big. And there's an example of a guy who had some hypermobility on top of kind of like a narrow frame. It was like, it was uncontrolled rotation that he recognized that he had to rein in, you know, not just in his swing, but in the way that he actually prepared for it. So it, you know, it goes both ways. Some guys want to minimize motion. Some people want to improve it so that they can, you know, have a longer runway over which to apply force.
Yeah. That's where it gets so interesting. Just all the nuance and understanding the guys who even like develop some or need some training habits, which kind of go counter to what's needed for their archetype. But
yeah,
helps them with an orientation or something that creates a positive outcome. That's, I think, what makes this a little bit of an art form as well, too.
Let's talk about the sprinting side of things, because I know you've got a huge background in really high level sprinters. I know you actually had a good conversation with Declan, one of our coaches in Florida, about kind of how you view you know, ISA as it relates to speed development. And, and admittedly, this is an area where I haven't dug, you know, nearly as deep as I have in terms of, I guess, frontal and transverse plane success. So, like, what are you seeing in that realm? Are there tendencies that you would hang your hat on?
Yeah, definitely. So I think really it helps us be more adaptive with the mental model of acceleration and max velocity mechanics. So if I take a narrow, we know they have a harder time creating the nutation. They have a harder time driving their center of gravity down versus a wide who can nutate. The center of gravity is right in front of S2. So if I nutate, I literally drive that center of gravity forward and down, right? That is the perfect position to accelerate, right? So when we think of, like, as we're all growing up as coaches, like 45 degree angles and, straight lines of symmetry and those types of things, yeah, that generally fits the wide archetype a little better. So they're a higher pressure system. They can nutate. They can drive the center of gravity down. They have a bigger IR window, which helps them in the longer ground contact. So where I think this gets pretty cool, Eric, is I had a post on Twitter several months ago, but I had a front side view of a wide and a narrow doing an acceleration. What you see with the narrow is you see it's more rotational. You see the splaying side to side more. A wide, they have the IR windows. Everything's kind of in front of the body. But if I think about this too, if I think of a narrow individual who's a fast, explosive guy, they're going to have to develop a lot of compressive strategies and orientations because they're naturally low pressure, mm-hmm. right? So I literally got to squeeze that tube of toothpaste an awful lot to pressurize. So if I squeeze them and I can create compression front to back, I got to create space, ER, to create a downforce. So this is why we see like the splaying side to side, and we may see more width in their initial acceleration, right? And this is where we'll see like, and there's, I think, a bandwidth to this, you'll see more of the backside mechanics, right? In an acceleration pattern. So yes, you could be working on that, improving that as they improve some of their IR capabilities as a narrow, but you're never going to see those same front side mechanics that you see in a wide individual. So this is where I've made a ton of mistakes over the years in terms of trying to coach that. But it also goes to cueing too. So like a wide, that may be somebody that you're coaching, like push out an acceleration because they're more ground-based, right? Mm-hmm. They're better force producers. Where an acceleration, the narrow, it may be switch,
slappy.
Right? Because they're quick impulses, okay? We're trying to get quick, aggressive switching of the thighs and those types of things. So, you know, the backside mechanics, the cueing, the positioning, understanding that is really important too. And then, you know, so we're lucky we have some 1080 motions. So we do some force velocity profiling on our guys. And even with the narrows, like you have to be careful how much you're trying to improve that. Say you're doing a 30 meter sprint, how much you're trying to improve that first 10. Because particularly in baseball, the way I may be doing it is via a ton of anterior orientation of the pelvis, right? Which could actually lock some of my rotation away from me, right? So that's where we just have to be super nuanced with what is the specific adaptation we're going to be driving from this. And then obviously to get to, longer sprints, we got 20, 30 meters doing some flying 10 work. This is where the narrows are going to excel. They can drop force straight up underneath them, the quick impulses. So I really have gone back to really training their strengths a lot more. And it goes to base run. Base running, yeah. We've really looked at a lot of their guys too, is I think the quintessential example would be like Ricky Henderson. Okay. Wide guy, like it was a super low heel recovery, right? It was a lot of front side mechanics, low heel recovery. Then go look at like D Gordon or Billy Hamilton and you see much higher heel. They're narrow guys, right? They kind of got up and ran where Ricky drove out. It's, you know, just being able to take our mental model and be able to add some nuance and individualization to it has been really, really helpful. So obviously in baseball, but same thing, training soccer guys or as we work with the track athletes here at Clemson is it's been pretty cool. Pretty cool to look at that. And even if I add another layer on that too. So say I have a narrow that I'm trying to improve the initial acceleration. Honestly, some of the areas I've had a lot of success are just by getting some of their IR capabilities back. Is that their spaces have moved back in a little bit and their foot strike is back underneath them a little bit more. So
So it's more of a chronic adaptation than it is like a cue in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So that's where it's been cool to kind of, you know, because we do some different resisted, variable resisted type work, and our 1080 sprint and all that is being able to look through this lens in terms of our application of it has made it really interesting.
And are you seeing pretty significant, I mean, let's be real, like, you know, we see guys sprinting with sleds, band resisted when it's, you know, convenient, obviously parachutes around and all that stuff for more of the top speed stuff. But when you're using the 1080 and all that stuff, are you finding that your narrow guys thrive much more when you train accelerations at much, much lower percentages because it allows you to train that switch? Whereas the wide guys, we both know you throw a little bit of load there and they go crazy and they seem to get faster with more weight to a period.
For sure. So yeah, we usually like the heavy, heavy protocols, I generally won't do with the narrows. Maybe in like a, if a, we have a guy here during the summer and it's like a true, like real off season, we may experiment with it a little bit, but it's outside their wheelhouse and it's outside their force signature. So like, yeah, those like 50% velocity decrement sprints, like where these guys are really pushing some or pulling some heavy loads. That's generally what we do with the wides and the narrows. We'll do more of like, or one thing, so it's cool in the 1080, we can do a variable resistance. So we may start them a little lighter and just tack on a tiny bit as they go through their first couple steps. So, but yeah, just kind of working more in their wheelhouse. I find we've gotten more ROI from that than trying to necessarily, quote unquote, work on the weakness.
I like it. I was going to ask you next about your assessments, but I think we hit a ton of them. So, you know, I think maybe let's talk about the actual the follow-up, the assessment, like the program design, the coaching, you know, what are the things that you think are really applicable across all sports? You know, not just, you know, obviously the baseball guys you're working with, but you've been in football, you've been in track and field, you've been in soccer.
Yeah.
Are there commonalities that you think, you know, really resound across all the disciplines?
Yeah. I think, you know, the first one really before getting into the nuts and bolts programming is kind of the mental model that you work through and you see this is, I think, what I've really developed over the last couple of years is the understanding of I'm trying to develop the output in sport with as little intervention through the weight room as possible, right? So just like that is the basis that forms the modeling and the programming off that. So if we are talking baseball, like I would rather gain 2 miles an hour on a pitcher via mechanical efficiency and working on movement than via the weight room just because of the cost of adaptation through that. Yeah. And I think that is such an important message for young strength coaches. And I'm guilty of it, especially early on, is, you know, your own narcissism drives you to want to be the reason for their success, right? So it's that. And then also just, you know, fully understanding, you know, this is to take a page from Mike Fergus Connolly, all the kind of co-actives. So the importance of the technical, the psychological, and the physical. But understanding that within each sport, but within each position and each individual within that position of that sport kind of sets the framework for you understanding how you're going to go about your training. And then from there, obviously, you know, you'll have an understanding of, you know, force capabilities and force outputs needed, impulses, your resiliency and energy system training, and those types of things. But for us, it really goes all back to structure too, in terms of positions that we're training, the impulses that we're training, even from some of the energy system work. A lot of that goes back to that. But I think I could go on forever about, you know, nuts and bolts of programming, but I think that's maybe the most important message for young strength coaches is, you know, whether it be a, you know, their sprint time, it's pitch velocity or whatever it may be, is can I drive that with as minimal weight room intervention as possible just because the cost of adaptation is so high. So if we're talking baseball and it's a, you know, a hitter that we're trying to get up to 75 mile an hour bat speed, if he has to trap our deadlift 650 pounds to do that and maintain that, the cost of adaptation is really high, both acutely within a season or off season, but also throughout a career. So that's always been a really important framework in which I think applies to all the sports. But I think, you know, baseball, highly skilled, you know, there's a high skill component and the high technical and tactical. So appreciating that versus like American football, where, you know, there's certainly the higher levels you get, it's more technical and tactical in nature, but there the physical element is even more important. I can take a basketball player who's never played football before, we've seen this before, and go play American football and be successful, right? Or rugby and some sports like that. So understanding those coactives and those types of things, I think is the good basis for you to then dive into, you know, the basic foundation principles of programming.
That's huge. And like, I guess one of the things I wrestle with is when did we get to this? You know what I mean? How did strength conditioning evolve as a profession where people, like, it was adamant that the sessions had to be 90 minutes. They had to be like the crazy, you know, yelling and screaming, because strength condition didn't exist. You know what I mean? If we're talking about the, you know, the 70s, like this was obviously very new and it started to take off. It's amazing that it became, you know, kind of discipline in and of itself, as opposed to something that was very supportive, like it's supposed to be. Like, I honestly feel like our job is just to put people in the best position possible to let the skill development folks do their thing, get us the heck out of the way. And I think physical therapy, athletic trainers, they've always felt this way as well, as, you know, keep guys on the field, let them practice as much as they can and build, you know, skill specific work capacity.
Well, I think one interesting thought on this, actually, I took this from Joel Smith, a conversation I had with him. Most of us as strength conditional professionals are wide ISAs who had a lot of success lifting heavy stuff in our sport and helping us in our sport application. Is taking that inherent bias from our own sporting background and applying that with a little bit of ego has gotten us to where we're at right now, right? And that's not to say, because I have plenty of guys that we're blowing up bar, we're getting aggressive with stuff, but I think all of us are biased from our sporting background. But you think about it, most of us got into strength conditioning because our pursuits in that realm helped us as athletes, right? And I think there's just so much overarching bias from that that affects the programming, and then mix that with, you know, some competitiveness and a little bit of ego. Is I think that's where, you know, kind of the residuals from that have had some negative impact.
Yeah. I mean, eventually the adaptations become maladaptations. Mm-hmm. It's not what you want. You know, we've spoken in the past about how challenging it is to actually pull together a high quality program. Like, I'm sure, you know, you were much like me early in your career. Like, you wrote stuff that you looked at 10 years later and you thought it was terrible. And, you know, I still do that, you know, even looking back like a year. You know, what advice would you give to young coaches who do want to write, you know, better programs? What's the best avenue through which they can pursue that goal?
Yeah, I think it's developing as many different lenses as possible to look through until you kind of, you know, develop kind of your best eye. So getting exposures to as many different systems and thought processes as possible, and running safe to fail experiments, right? That's ultimately how you're going to evolve. If you're afraid or apprehensive of taking small calculated risks, you'll never evolve and you'll never grow. So that's always been it's actually something I got from Dan Path too. I remember years ago listening to him talk. He said 10 to 20% of your program should always be experimental. Yeah. And obviously you're doing that in safe,
fail forward, right?
Cities and places and times a year. But ultimately that's what's going to help your evolution, your growth. That's, you know, Bill Hartman uses the safe to fail experiment. That's kind of his saying. So, you know, taking that and not being afraid to try things. But I think, you know, always trying to justify everything that you're doing and asking why. And if you can't, you need to go back and research that further and be able to provide a better understanding. I know myself, like, we had some of our pro guys back this off season, even just some guys that are gone like 2 years ago. I was like, sorry, man, like I messed this up with you. I think we have a better approach with some of that now. But, you know, the aspect of being humble and being a continual learn is really important. Understanding there's no finish lines, right? Like your buddy Morris used to say, you're always in search of the Holy Grail, knowing you're never going to find it, right? And that's kind of like with me diving into Bill's model so much is, you know, I'll never understand that, not 10% as well as Bill, but it gives me a nice finish line I'm always searching for, knowing I'll never reach, right? So I think those are the most important things is not being afraid to try things in a safe environment, and, you know, reaching out to and being a generalist, which, you know, helped me out a ton for as long as you can, and you're going to develop, you know, some better lenses to see things. And that's how you get a ton of reps. Like if you want to, we talk about assessments and looking at postures and different movement patterns, is you need a ton and ton and ton and ton of reps on that. And oftentimes that's just not going to happen just working with one sport, right? Yeah. You need to get involved in multiple settings, and you see different presentations. And like we talk about some pitching examples, is you're going to see the crazy adaptation, which, you know, in terms of the human body would be perceived as a male adaptation, but it's actually favorable for their sport. Is you just got to get a ton of reps of that.
Yeah. I think that's vitally important, is, you know, this concept of the generalist, because you have to have a lot of breadth before you can have depth. Like it's a very important thing, because that breadth is what allows you to recognize where you should hone in the deepest, right? Is you think about it, you got exposed to a lot of different things. You got exposed to this, you know, expansive compressive model, and you were able to take it and apply it in this specific realm that you had. Baseball, right? I've got 35 guys that I need to be all in to appreciate this, how this works for them. And it's very similar with me. Like people think when we founded Cressy Sports Performance that we were going to be baseball guys. I'm like, hey, 2007, we were training whoever would help us pay our bills. We had marathoners, we had, you know, NFL combine prep, we were, you know, training basketball players, you name it, golfers, whatever allowed us to keep our doors open. So I think that's a really important consideration.
Don't mind me adding in, is I think even as I've talked a lot about expansion compression models, you know, it was a 16 year journey to get to that point. Yeah. It was Shirley Sarmon. It was Vladimir Yanda. Yeah. It was SFMA. It was many years of PRI. It was DNS, and, you know, adding another layer and layer and layer to this lens. So eventually I kind of found a model that was the most comprehensive and helped me connect dots and see movement the most clearly that I had to this point. But always searching to find something that's going to help you answer the questions even better, and you know, never being satisfied, and understanding if there's certain problems and puzzles you can't solve, is, you know, you need to arm yourself with further knowledge or another lens that you can look through.
Yeah. Or in many cases, these new things you're exposed to, they help you understand why you had success in the past, and you thought you had success for very different reasons. I feel like that happens quite a bit nowadays. I've been more and more exposed to fascial manipulation through my business partner, Shane, who's a recent podcast guest. And sure enough, it's like, oh, that's why they treated his infraspinatus and his anterior shoulder pain went away for 3 days. But then it came back, you know, after that, here's the other area they should have treated to make sure that change sticked. And here's the exercise modification we should have made. Like you start to see things in different realms. But, you know, maybe on that note, you know, what's been your biggest growth area over the past year? Obviously, this has been a deep dive. I think your exact quote to me over text was, I've really buried my head in the sand on this stuff. but in this past year, you know, what's changed the most? What's the stuff that, you know, has been the aha, you know, kind of elements for you?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, working through expansion compression model, but then taking that and using that lens to dissect, you know, movement of our hitters, movement of our pitchers, and then the analytics end. So actually it's cool. Myself and our director of sports science, Jason Avedisian, we kind of work together and run our baseball analytics team. So a couple of years ago, I was like, well, you know, I'm affecting the body, but the body affects the ball. I need to really understand these metrics and the movement in a ton of depth. So that's cool, because I don't do all the coding and all that. Kind of Jason helps, and with our students and all that. But I'm kind of the conduit that goes back to the coaching staff. And this is the question we're trying to solve. This is the movement of the body. and connecting those dots has been really, really helpful. And I think that's the thing that gets me most excited nowadays is understanding expansion compression better, applying it to kinematics and looking at movement, but then also to adding in the analytic end is so fascinating, and I can geek out on it and you can never learn enough of it. But I think the overarching theme from that, which we talked about with younger coaches, is, you know, the number one impediment to relationships with sport or technical coaches is not being able to speak the language.
Yeah.
Right. And the avenue to fostering and cultivating that relationship is being able to speak the language. So the further and deeper I get into that, you know, obviously the better relationship I have with our staff, I connect to recruits, but also when I'm talking to different orgs and all that, I'm going to get better as a coach. Okay. If I'm almost 20 years into this, I'm not reading the NSCA Journal of Strength Conditioning Research, right? Like, it's going to come from nuance and understanding the sport and being able to be more specific with application. So for those that have been practitioners for a long time and have that generalist background, this is the time in which you really, really specialize. You get really down into the roots and all that. But I'm going to get better over the next several years as I develop better and better conversations and relationships with hitting coaches, pitching coaches, baseball analytic minds, and can connect my pieces with them in that realm, right? And it's not going to be like, you know, post activation potentiation of a deadlift, like,
yeah,
who freaking cares at this point in time, right?
Yeah, you'll seek out more opportunities to be the dumbest guy in a room. Like, that's, you know, two decades in, it's vitally important. Sometimes you got to say or ask stupid questions in order to get where you want to be, but you got to have the humility to do it, right?
Absolutely. And that was, you know, with soccer in particular, you know, football background guy, big guy, like, man, I had to spend so much time learning the sport and the nuance to be able to speak the language to the coach that he had confidence in my application of the program. So that's really, you know, been diving super deep into that. And that's, you know, I think that's where the plan's going to be for the next couple of years. But that's the cool thing about, I think why I specialize in baseball is it's not as open reactive a sport as American football or soccer is. You know, I can, you know, our pitching coach, Jimmy Bellinger, he's awesome. Like, we can look at a pitcher, go, hey, we change his initial stance. We move his left-handed pitcher, move his right foot back a little bit, opens up some early IR for him. Mm-hmm. He can hold on to a better directionality. Like, I can't do that in another sport. So that's what makes it so exciting and fascinating is you have these unique challenges that you can work through that aren't afforded necessarily in other sports.
Absolutely. Well, and building on that last question, I know you're a super progressive guy. You're always thinking about ways to get better. I joke with this question. I ask it a lot, but what's rattling around your brain at 3 a.m. now when you stare off into blackness and you're wondering about stuff? Like, I know I have my questions, and you know, you even hinted a little bit of is how we can take some of this this ISA model that we use really, really well with pitchers and apply it more with our hitters. And there were a couple of things that you said that I want to dig deep in on, go back and watch a lot of video. But I'm curious, what gets you excited in the middle of the night when you're brainstorming?
Gosh, it's all the puzzles.
Yeah.
Going back to baseball, like of individual players. And I think, like we said earlier, is that fluid state of when we're altering the program and the focus is like always constantly about. It's like the barometer is always there measuring that. And that's what I lose sleep over is understanding exactly the point when to turn left, when to turn right. But and two, like with the metrics and all that, just understanding how, you know, positions of, you know, supination, pronation bias and twists in the radius and humerus and all these different things, how that's really, really affecting some of the metrics and different things that we're looking at is, you know, that's where the future of the game is and where the best player development lies. And, you know, I want to be pretty freaking good at that.
we always wrap up with a lightning round. So we'll throw a couple at you that I think will be slam dunks. What's one book that every coach should read?
I'll go with Good to Great.
It's all good.
I really enjoyed that one.
Classic. If you could go back in time and give young Rick some advice 25 years ago, say, what would it be? We'll say high school, Rick.
Man, I go personally, some of the training stuff I was doing, that would be an easy takeaway. I think appreciation certainly of, like I mentioned before, kind of the co-actives, all the different elements beyond the physical. Cause even me as a player, like it was weight room's going to get me better. Weight room's going to get me better. Weight room's going to get me better. And then I was a terrible technician, you know, with my hands and all that as a rush end and those types of things. So I think really understanding that, not wanting to be the reason that the athlete's having success. Yes, certainly you want to impact as much as you can, but you got to understand the impact that others are making and appreciate that and understand you're one stakeholder in a larger puzzle piece and conversation.
I like that. And then last one, there are actually a lot of kids and parents who listen to this podcast together. We may have gone over their head at times a little bit with this stuff. But, there's a lot of great clinicians and sports performance people on here too that will benefit. But I am curious, like we all know that one of our jobs when we deal in the private sector is to prepare high school kids for their first day in a college weight room. Like they roll in, they have to interact with you. What advice would you give to those people about your expectations of, you know, you're going to get those guys that show up in July at Clemson and you want them to be able to hit the ground running. Like, what is it that these players and parents need to know about how they can effectively hit the ground running when they arrive at a Clemson or any other big time university, you know, in the summer or fall of their freshman year?
Yeah, really good question. I think it's two things that are probably related. The first one is I want them to maximize their outputs as great as possible without having to rely on the weight room for them as much. If that makes sense. So the example I always give is think of like your Mike Trouts and your Bryce Harpers. You see, like a lot of these, and maybe it's changed a little bit recently, but your guys that are become these big power hitters in the big leagues, they weren't like that at 18. Right? Like they had these high bat speeds, exit velocities. And you know, obviously there's a lot of inherent talent and physical qualities, but they developed those kind of without a ton of weight room intervention and then stacked weight room intervention on top of the skill that drove the output first. Right? If that makes sense, versus trying to drive the weight room and then put the skill on top of it, right? Because what we see all the time, or like pitching example, what a guy did to get to 92 in high school may make it really hard for him to get to 95, 96 in college, right? So it's maximize output off skill and efficiency and sprinting and throwing med balls and athleticism, and then stack the weight room on top of that. And then here's the other rule of thumb we use with all our commits is, while you're lifting in high school, no sticking points, right? Just like being able to, and especially when we're dealing with a lot of narrows, there's certainly there are some wides, but you know, we can certainly get stronger, develop some good positions with no sticking points, as we'll limit some of the orientations and compressive strategies, which will make a much easier runway for us as we start the process on the college campus. So those are kind of the big things. And you know, obviously for some kids in high school, they got to sell out a little bit to give themselves a chance to get there. But, you know, for the kids coming to Clemson, you know, usually they can get there without having to completely sell out in the weight room and being what we term like a young, mature, you know, kid who looks like he's been playing pro ball for 4 years, but he's a senior in high school. Right.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So move it fast and be technically proficient is the name of the game. I like it. Hey, this is awesome. Super informative. I picked up some good stuff and probably more importantly, got me a little intrigued to go watch a lot of video after we wrap up. Folks can find you. It's at Franzball Rick on Twitter.
Yeah.
You mentioned some good stuff. And actually I scrolled down. I just found it while we were talking the video on some of the sprint mechanics that you talked about. So definitely folks can check you out there and I'll throw it in the show notes. Man, you're doing amazing things at Clemson. Those athletes are really lucky to have you. And, you know, as a friend, as a peer, it's been really cool to see how you've evolved and done some really, really cool stuff from afar. So I always enjoy our conversations and this is certainly no exception. So thanks for taking the time.
Appreciate it a lot, Eric. You're a guy I really looked up to in the baseball and strength conditioning industry in general. So that means a lot, man. Appreciate it.
We're both young bucks. We got a long way to go. So let's plan on doing this again. All right.
Yeah, definitely, man. Appreciate you.
Thanks for taking the time.